Hi, my name is Tomás McIntyre. We're back here in the picturesque Ballyfarter village on the Sleighhead Drive, 8 miles west of Dingle.
I assume, Tomás, over the last while, where we are at the moment has been completely different to where you've experienced over the last couple of months. Tell me about it.
Yeah, firstly, it's always great getting home. But yeah, the last few months there, I suppose, I was away out in the Middle East. So lots of difference, especially cultural differences, I guess. But yeah, beautiful place of the world to visit nonetheless. Cradle of civilization, places like Iran. Seeing the Karakoram Highway of Pakistan was an incredible experience, but I guess nothing beats cycling around Sleighhead as well on a lovely wet day.
Tell me where it all began for you. You've cycled, as you say yourself, almost the length of the world. Tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, so it's mostly been on and off, really, but I started back in 2016. I cycled across the USA from San Diego across to St. Augustine. So that was my first trip. That took about 7 weeks. That one was in aid of the Donald Walsh Live Life Foundation as well. And then I followed that trip up in 2018, 2019 with a trip to Africa. I think at that stage I thought I maybe had one more big trip. I wanted to do one big trip because the plan was to go back to university, get my teacher's degree, and to go off teaching someplace. And we all know what happens after that. You settle down, and next thing you're married, kids running around you, and the bike is gathering dust in the shed. So I did Africa top to bottom. That took 7 months, I think, 7 or 8 months. That was, again, in aid of the Donald Walsh Live Life Foundation. And then I did go back to university after that. Went up to UCD to try a master's in international relations, and 1 week and I was back at home again. So didn't quite work out, and then booked a one-way ticket to New Zealand to cycle home. And I guess that's the same trip that I'm on today, but it's been going into, well, we're now 2024, so it's gone into year four, and I think I'm only just over halfway through it. So.
Oh my God, it's like doing a degree in itself.
Yeah. A PhD in probably world traveling or something like that. So
you see, obviously it took you 7 months to go across Africa. Like, what were the conditions like? Where were you staying? Because obviously you weren't checking into hotels every night.
No, so you kind of, you'd sleep just about anywhere, I'd say. So anything from police checkpoints to sleeping out in the Sahara desert amongst the locals. You had these roadside cafes or restaurants, just open buildings, you know, and people would just stop there for some food or just a cup of tea or something, just to take a break from, I guess, the long drive from the capital of Sudan up to the border with Egypt. But then they had like another separate room where there was like these bed cots, and basically it was just a cot and that was it. And you just had to sleep on it or sleep on the floor or find somewhere comfortable. So I'd usually just put down my sleeping mat or something, or you might get lucky and there might be a blanket or something there as well. And then you'd have your cheap guest houses in the cities, you'd have your hostels, and then pretty much anything after that was police stations, camping, and you could pretty much just camp anywhere in a field. I camped on the side of the road, I camped in the middle of a town in a parking lot before, I camped at police stations, they'd often let you camp, camped out in the desert in Namibia, South Africa, you'd camp near the beaches along the coast, and yeah, just pretty much everywhere and anywhere, really. So,
how was your sleep quality?
Most of the time it was fine, because I guess you were tired from all the cycling and stuff and just the whole kind of adventures of that day, because you're always meeting people, you're always chatting away to people, then you're obviously doing your bits of cycling and stuff as well. So most of the time, by the time it got to 9, 10 o'clock, you'd just be fast asleep.
Mm-hmm. So I'd imagine when you came back from that, and as you say, you went over to New Zealand, you had to probably have a chat with your family and be like, I'm not done here. I need to go again.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm kind of, because I do these trips by myself, it's I guess I'm a bit of a dictator. I'm just like, if I want to go, that's it. I'm just, mm-hmm. I'll book it.
You're
like
your
God.
Own boss.
Yeah, I try not to dwell too much, and I don't want to, because I think if you start thinking about things too much, then you might talk yourself out of it or whatever. So at least once you, like I knew once I had the trip, the flight to New Zealand booked, that was it. It was locked in. I think I booked it in October to leave in January. And once it's locked in, that's it. There's no kind of backing out then. And then I just immediately started to look into the trip and where I wanted to cycle through on the long journey home. And that kept me preoccupied till January anyways. Between that and working, trying to save up as much money as I could. I didn't really have much time to think about what was actually ahead of me. It was just, right, that's now time to get ready for it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of getting ready, what exactly would you pack?
So, what did I... Well, obviously the bicycle is... Can't go anywhere without the bicycle. And then just the essentials. So camping gear, cooking gear. So like a little pot to cook with, little stove, camping gear. You'd have your tent, sleeping bag, sleeping mattress, and then like a little blow-up pillow. But everything's all really small, compactable, because you don't want to carry too much weight, because that's everything.
Because that's all going on your back, more or less.
Yeah. So you've got like pannier bags. So you got a pannier rack attached, and then you got your bags, and then so everything you carry is just going to be more weight to carry on the bicycle. And I guess over time I've realized that you don't need as much stuff, and that kind of works into other ways of life as well. Now that like I'm back at home living again, I'm just like, I don't need to be buying all these clothes, I don't need to be buying all these pairs of shoes or anything like that. So you kind of continue life as a minimalist, but and then just some electronics, spare clothes, maybe a spare cycling top, a couple of jackets in case if the weather changes. And then, yeah, just some medical stuff. Spare cash always comes in handy. A spare wallet as well, because if it happens that you were to get robbed, it's always good to have just like a wallet with maybe just a small sum of cash, maybe like 20 quid or something, 10 quid. And at least if somebody goes to rob you, you can just hand over that wallet and keep your own wallet.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, so you do pick up some little tips like that along the way from other people as well. And now, since for example, I bought a new phone, so I've kept my old phone as a spare, because like your battery might die, and at least you can put your SIM card into your old phone and that's fully charged. You may never use it, but it's just another backup plan as well, because not every place I go you can charge up your your electronics. So it's handy to have that as a spare as well.
Yeah. Now, obviously you did all of this solo as well, so how was that? Because I imagine once you're in your head, it's you on your own, you're meeting other people, and you kind of have to go out. I'm not sure if you're very sociable, but you'd have to go out of your comfort zone, especially with different cultures.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I've been fortunate to have met some people along the way as well, so I may plan and go on these trips on my own, but you know, you'll always find some few people cycling around as well. Like when I was in Africa, for example, the Cairo to Cape Town, it's just one route down the east of Africa before you cross over the centre and eventually over to West Africa to finish in Cape Town, which is in the southwest of South Africa. But you don't really have a whole lot of road choice, I guess, you know, because once you kind of stray off the main roads in some African countries, you're just getting onto dirt tracks and stuff, which are really fun to cycle as well. But like Africa was probably the easiest place to actually meet people, whereas in Southeast Asia, for example, I barely met any cyclist, and even the ones that, you know, most of the ones that I did were going in the opposite direction. But then there's more road choice to pick from, there's more places to, you know, better road conditions once you kind of even stray off the main roads as well. But then I guess, you know, cycling it by myself as well, I'm just used to it now. Like I would be sociable now because like I'm working a bar and stuff, and
you had no choice then.
Yeah, exactly. But then when you're meeting people as well, you know, you're learning all about their life and stuff, and it's you know, you kind of, I wouldn't want to be quiet when you're meeting so many different people as well, because then you might not get to know about them or get to actually talk to them properly and stuff. And then yeah, like you said, all the different cultures as well. I mean, I think the only place I haven't cycled yet is South America. So, you know, you've done the Middle East, Central Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, top to bottom and stuff. So you've learned so much about other people's ways of life. And then that's a conversation you can bring to the table as well. Like when I was in the Middle East, and if I told someone I'd cycle in Africa, you know, they may never have been to Africa. So they're curious and they want to know about life there and stuff as well. So you're not short on talking points anywhere I go.
Yeah. And tell me, obviously, there was so many cultures that you met. What were the ones that really stood out to you?
I guess definitely like, and this has probably been a bit common, especially we'll say in the more poorer regions or the regions of the world that, you know, the West may look down on, just how incredibly generous and kind people are. One thing from day one that I never thought would happen is that so many people would be interested in me when I'm cycling. And anywhere I've gone, you know, people will come up to you and they'll look at the bike and they'll just ask, like, where are you going? Are you okay? Do you need anything? And that's just been commonplace everywhere. Just so how generous people are. But then I found where I've got into, you know, the more poorer countries like Malawi, where, you know, one of the poorest countries in the world, yet people are so willing to help, you know, and they're so willing to give and they want to be part of the journey. They want to take care of you, even if it's just for a night or whatever. They just want to be part of it. And they don't look for anything in return, you know. Then you go to other countries, we'll say, like Sudan, Iran, Afghanistan, which are, I guess, kind of looked down upon by Western countries for XYZ reasons. And but then, you know, the people, I always say, like, the people are never a true representation of their government, because their government may do bad things, but the people, you know, the local people are extremely kind, extremely welcoming, so curious about travelers, and, you know, they're just delighted to get to meet you, and you get to spend the evening with them. They'll always insist you stay longer than one night. They'll feed you all the time. They'll take you places, and they make a huge deal out of it, I guess, because they'll invite their friends, they'll invite their family over. The whole village kind of comes out as well.
Just there with your bike?
Just there with my bike, yeah, yeah. And they just found it so baffling. But then, you know, tourists do visit a lot of these countries, but I guess being on a bicycle, you kind of, I guess, you know, you need to eat, you need to sleep, you need to rest, you need to drink and stuff. So you stop quite often during the day. And, you know, you may stop in villages where people don't see foreigners too often, or they might not see them at all, because usually, you know, they're flying into countries. And like when I was in Afghanistan, I went across the country, but other tourists were flying in. And then instead of like taking the bus or whatever across, they might just fly from East Afghanistan across to West Afghanistan, and vice versa. So like they would miss the smaller villages where they don't get to see foreigners too often. So, you know, it's a big deal for them too. So it does bring excitement to their day. And then I've always wondered, like, after I've left, like, what do they say? Like, what do they think about me? Like, was I okay? Was I what they expected, or were they like disappointed that, you know? I don't know. Yeah.
I don't think they'd be disappointed, because again, I suppose, like that question you said there, where are you going? I suppose your answer was Ireland.
Yeah, and they knew, like, you know, they would know that you're moving and stuff. Like in Africa, what to say, for example, I was in Ethiopia, and someone, and like always, and this was true of most of Africa, really. You know, people would be walking along the road, which happens a lot out there, and they just start shouting, like, "Hi, how are you? Where you go?" And you'd say, I'd always, like, at the beginning, I would be like, "Oh, South Africa." But you could see, you know, they don't, I guess, it's not that they couldn't understand it, but they just couldn't comprehend, like, why is he going to South Africa? So then what I started doing was, if I was in Kenya, for example, and if I was in Northern Kenya or West Kenya cycling, and someone says, "Oh, where you go?" I would say Nairobi, because they'd know where Nairobi was. They'd, you know, and they'd be like, "Wow, like, why?" Like, and then you show them a map, and, you know, you'd be chatting away with them, and then you'd be like, "Oh, well, I'm actually going down here, but just like in Kenya, this is where I'm heading to first." And they couldn't, like, they wouldn't comprehend why I would even about cycling like that in Kenya. They're just like, "Why can't you just take a car or the bus or something, or just fly to South Africa? Like, why do you want to?" So, but it was just the innocence of the conversation, I guess. I mean, look, if someone came to Ireland, and if I hadn't known about cycling touring, and somebody just casually walked into the pub there, and I was asked them where they were cycling to, and they'd be like, "Oh, I'm cycling home to New Zealand." You'd be like, "What? You wouldn't even cycle into Dingle half the time. Never mind Dublin or anywhere else up the country. Like, but New Zealand is like the other side of the world, the furthest country away from Ireland." So, yeah.
And was the language barrier a difficulty for yourself?
I mean, yeah. Like, a lot of the times people wouldn't have English, but there's always ways around it, you know. Like, telling someone that you wanted to eat, drink, or sleep is universally understood. And then, but I've never, like, I guess I've never got into trouble with the language barrier, you know. Like, there's always a way around it. And then, look, a lot of the time I've met someone and you would love to have got a proper conversation with them, but because I don't speak their language, or they wouldn't speak English, you know, it's
there's just that barrier that you can't cross.
Yeah, it's been a lot of regret as well. But I mean, look, there's so many languages to learn from, or to learn as well. But it is a huge shame. Like, I'd love, saying that again, though, I wouldn't want everyone to be able to speak English, because it's great that people can still speak their own home languages. And, you know, in Africa, you know, we'll say Southern Africa, they might speak a lot of Swahili, but they also have their local languages that are still alive and booming as well, which is great. You know, languages we've probably never heard of. But even with the Taliban in Afghanistan, not being able to speak local language, or them not being able to speak English, it wasn't a huge issue. Like, we could still, I guess, get our points across without having to fully understand what one another were saying. And there was never any issue. I've never ran into trouble because of that. I've never felt as if, like, I need to understand what they're saying, because I feel as if something's going to happen if I don't, you know, kind of way. So, but maybe that's just down to pure luck as well. But yeah, touch wood, that doesn't
always. I suppose in that as well, did you ever have any fears when you were traveling, or was it all just a positive impact? I imagine there were some doubts at times.
I suppose I'd have self-doubt that I wouldn't be able to do it all. And then other fears would be, to be honest, traffic is the big one. I mean, even Ireland, like, the traffic here, it's not particularly safe on roads to cycle. People have been injured, and fortunately people have passed away too. Anywhere I've been, traffic has been the major one. I probably couldn't name one country where you'd feel 100% safe on roads anywhere. And then other fears would be just, like, health-related issues and stuff as well. Like, I've been to hospital a couple of times. And, you know, when stuff like that happens, you not only worry about yourself, but you also then start to worry about, like, your family and stuff. And, like, like, I went to hospital I was crossing the border between Malaysia and Thailand last year. It was during Ramadan. So around this time last year, to be honest. But I ended up getting a bad stitch in my belly, or down the side of my stomach or whatever. And I just thought it was another dose of diarrhea or whatever, because I had that quite often up until that stage. And then it didn't turn out to be that at all. It ended up being kidney stones. But I'd been taken to hospital, and I wasn't in touch with my family. I called my aunt, because she's a GP, and she was the one who was just like, you need to get to hospital, it's not diarrhea, it's something more serious than that. But I hadn't been able to get in touch with mom or dad or my brother or my sister. So as I was being carted off the hospital, I was just like, and actually, funnily enough, going back to the whole language thing, now that that's come back into my head about that story, the ones who came to the hotel, none of them could speak English. None of the healthcare workers, the ambulance crew, none of them could speak English. So I obviously started bawling my eyes out, because I was just like, I have no idea what's wrong with me. I was just like, I don't know if this is going to be the end of the trip. I don't know if I'm going to be in hospital for a long time. I didn't have health insurance. So obviously that's a huge risk. I wouldn't recommend that to people who go long-term traveling. So as I was being taken to the hospital, I was just crying and crying and crying, and no clue what was going on. Got to the hospital, no doctor could speak English, no nurse could speak English. And eventually, I think it was the third or fourth doctor that came to me that could speak English, but it was like quite broken English, but he could still understand. And thankfully, he was actually a cyclist as well himself, so he put two and two together very quickly, and he realized that it was kidney stones for me not looking after myself properly. So healthcare fears, and then the whole language thing jumping in there too. And then that was really, until in Africa, there was just fears of animals and stuff. I had a couple of close calls with lions.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and then there was elephants in Botswana. You had the elephant highway. It's like a 300 or 350k kilometer stretch, kind of north to south Botswana. It's just called Elephant Highway. It's just through Chobe National Park. And the road just goes right through the middle of it. So, you see elephants every day. But there was a close call with a lion there. Another close call with a lion in Tanzania. That's really been it. I had a gun pointed at me in Sudan, but that was my own fault. I cycled down the road. I shouldn't have cycled down, but it was the quickest way to get out of the city. But it was down, like, where all the embassies and stuff are. But I just, when I saw the soldier run out and point, I just looked the other way and I just kept sprinting. I was just like,
get out of here fast.
Yeah, I was just like, I highly doubt he's going to shoot me in the back. So I was just like, yeah, I think I'm okay. But yeah, I just sprinted as quick as I could. But apart from that, I've been quite lucky, I guess. But 99% of the people I've met are good people.
What did you learn most about yourself?
I guess, before, I kind of always, I kind of still do, you know, like everyone, self-doubt's always kind of creeping, but I guess I've realized that, like, once I put my mind to something, I really want to do something, then I know I have the capabilities of doing it, because, like, I've kind of, even on the trips, like, you do still get low moments, but I always know that when I do feel low, that I can pick myself up again, and I think that's been quite, probably one of the most important learnings, and that I can look after myself. You know, if I am in a spot of bother, like with the whole kidney stones things, like I was able to get myself and the bike to the hotel, a cheap hotel to throw my stuff off. And then, you know, I was able to call for help instead of just lying in the bedroom hoping that it might go away or whatever. And yeah, like any time I'm in a spot of bother, like I've always been able to wiggle myself out of it.
That's a skill in itself.
Yeah. And then just the fact that, like, you know, you're traveling all around the world. I've been able to get on really well with people. I've been able to put myself out there. I've been able to, you know, try to see life from a different perspective as well. So, yeah, it's been really kind of a fantastic trip, like a huge learning curve. And I guess it's just a huge education lesson in itself as well.
If you were to offer anyone advice who would even attempt to try and do what you do, what would you say?
So definitely, like, don't overtrain before you go. Like, I haven't cycled a bike since I came home, and I'll go again in October, November. But if I don't cycle a bicycle before then, you know, I'm not going to dwell on it. So you absolutely don't need to overtrain. Just arm yourself with a smile, a good attitude, and kind of a open mindset, because I guess you will encounter or see things or hear things that you're not going to like. And I guess in that way, you don't want to stay quiet about things as well, but, you know, there's a time and place for everything, I suppose. But yeah, just arm yourself with a smile, an open mindset, and a good attitude, and just be understanding of other ways of life and stuff, because obviously it's not similar to our culture here. You know, every country and region and part of the world and continent have different cultures and stuff like that. So, but yeah, just be yourself and just enjoy every moment, because, you know, you're off doing something that many of the world unfortunately can't do. So we are very privileged coming from Ireland as well, you know, that I can just work until I don't want to work, and then I can just jump off of my bicycle and take off traveling again. So, you know, it is a very privileged position, so I want to be understanding of that too.
And finally, where are you hoping to go next? Where does the next 12 months hold for you?
Yeah, so I'll be home till next winter, and then I left my bicycle with my cousin in Dubai. So I guess I'll have to go back and collect it and hopefully finish a trip off. That's the next plan. I want to, it's been 4 years now, and next year it's going to be 5. So I think it's time to finish it. And then, yeah, come home and then see what's next. Like South America, I still want to do. It's the only continent I haven't cycled yet. So I'll try and mix South and Latin America together. And then after that, it's probably just like regions or places I'm keen to go back and see, maybe like West Africa. I haven't done parts of Europe as well. I mean, like when I cycle across Europe is another huge continent, obviously, as well. So there's definitely parts of Europe, other parts of Europe I'd like to see. I'd love to go back to Central Asia again, back to Iran, Pakistan, Afghan, New Zealand again would be great. Southeast Asia, yeah, I don't know. But yeah. Look, I'll have to.
The list is endless.
Yeah, but I'll also have to look forward to other stuff as well, maybe non-bike related, like where I'm going with my own life and what direction I want to go on that, and if I'm going to go back to university again, or if I'll try maybe set up my own cycle tours or adventure tours company or something like that. Or,
well, life is short and you can really achieve anything.
Yeah, well, that's it. So I'm not going to panic yet. I'm not going to overthink about it. I'll just one day at a time.
Exactly. Well, Tomás, it's been lovely to talk to you, and especially here in the bar as well. So thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, not a bar. And thanks a million for coming out. Wasn't the nicest day to drive out from today, but much appreciated.
We got there. I'm sure you cycled worse. Yeah.